Hey Bunty, greetings from San Francisco. Marnin, some of you had asked what Marnin is. Just something Bunty and I have been saying since we were kids because we had a Hindi teacher who used to say that. So Marnin, and how's stuff with you, man?
Double morning. It is good in London. All is well. I think we are kind of obviously, unlike you, we're kind of winding down towards the end of a rather eventful weekend. Lots of saw a couple of movies, did some interesting range-based shooting, which I was telling you about, rifle shooting, which is a really interesting experience. But no, glad to be back again. I think we were talking last week. We posted something up, quite a few listens. I think we picked up in conversation that we are now ranked the number fourth political podcast, though I don't think we're explicitly political. And the other podcasts who were listed in front of us were had big media machineries behind them. So the fact that two friends chatting from two parts of the world about India stacks up as number four. Do you know, Rohit, do you remember the bunch of guys who kind of called us out on it? Because I
I
think
guess
we'll
I'll
shout
have
out to
to.
them later on, but I think it was a really interesting feed. In fact, I can also look it up from my phone. I just felt really pleased that the fact that with the work that we've done over the last 3 years on this, it just come to pass, and it is at such a good place. But anyway, we talk about that later on.
Yeah,
What's
I think it's
you?
blogfeedspot.com. So Feedspot
Okay.
is the name of the enterprise, I think. And I think in their blog they featured it, and we are number four. And it was very heartening. We were obviously like sort of thoroughly delighted
Yes.
to be rated. And as always, very, very grateful to people who listen, because we know what a precious commodity time is, and it's
Yeah,
not
absolutely.
something we
Absolutely.
take for granted. And please, India Explained Podcast at gmail.com. If we haven't responded to your emails or haven't checked with the multiple email accounts we have, we don't always check regularly, but please we will, and please do send in your suggestions. We thought today we'll do one of those episodes which is just a sort of state of the union, reflecting on a few things. Last time, we picked up, we kind of shared an update, and we mentioned this Air India story. So I don't want to spend too much time on it, but just a sequel to it. See, in India, everything basically follows the logic of one of those ZTV serials, episode number 356. Sass Bahu fighting for like 7 years. So we know there's this guy, Shankar Mishra. I mean, not doxing him, it's all over the place. Guys on an Air India plane, gets drunk, urinates on an elderly lady. Air India sorts it out, but they do so in a very nasty way. They don't give her empty first class seat, force her to go back to the same seat. Guy's very abashed, pays for her dry cleaning. The staff doesn't do anything. They let the guy go away scot-free. He gives a fake address. Long story short, she writes to the director of, or CEO of the company. It's privatized again under Tata's. Guy's arrested, etc. Now his lawyer's in court, and in an extremely poorly written, like grammatically really poorly written kind of brief, the lawyer's claiming that the lady urinated on herself. And what's bizarre is she claims that the lady has some kind of enlarged prostate. And I don't think women have a prostate. This is what doctors have pointed out. The other logic is that she was a Kathak dancer, and Kathak dancers are incontinent. So anyway, that's where it stands. In between, the guy's father also came and gave some excuses. So I just had a couple of questions, and I've shared these twice on Twitter, so bear with me repeating myself, middle age, etc. But here's what I want to know. So the lady urinates on herself. She's urinated on herself. The guy goes to her seat, exposes himself when he's drunk, and then he pays for her dry cleaning. Like, what am I missing here? Please tell.
No, this is, see, this doesn't need Sherlock, right? The facts arranged in any order show up discrepancies. So even assuming for a moment that this man didn't do what is being implied, there are three charges: urination, indecent exposure, and then there is also harassment, some low-grade harassment that happened after in a kind of a confrontation situation. So you're absolutely right, Rohit. If this guy hasn't done anything wrong, why pick up the tab on the dry cleaning? Because, you know, that's not a done thing. So yeah, look, I think this matters in the court of law. I feel bad for that guy, only because not the guy. I feel bad for his family, because what has happened is, I mean, imagining he's got a young child who goes to school. That child's life is going to get very difficult for the next 3 to 4 years, because, you know, in India, when your parents or somebody related to you does something odd or is in the media for the wrong reasons, it just opens up a Pandora's of nastiness. And I'm just hoping that the man who has done wrong should be punished. And let's step back a little bit. And also, I'm not trying to justify this guy, but look, you know, he clearly is in the wrong. A mistake has been made. He should pay the price for it judicially, whatever punishment is there. But, you know, we are not in the Middle Ages, right? That, you know, he should be hung, drawn, and quartered. His family should be pelted with tar and feather. So, you know, there has to be a sense of proportionality about this as well.
That's wonderful.
We should respect. I mean, my concern goes out to the family, not for this guy. This guy has done it wrong, and now he's trying to wiggle. And I hope his wiggles get caught out and he's nailed for the wrongdoing that he has carried out. But let's just be decent and civil about his family, because they haven't done anything.
This is a really good point. Really good point you make. And maybe at some point in a future episode, we can circle back to this notion of public humiliation in India, because I think about this sometime. You know, when, you know, you had a classmate who didn't do well in class, the person was shamed always, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how is it anyone's damn business what someone's kid gets, right? Everyone asking, people get labeled. And then what happens is it destroys their confidence. And so in many ways, you know, it's a very brutal society. And it's part of the hypocrisy of what are called the middle classes, but are actually professional white collar classes.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, this culture of public humiliation also cuts across different social sectors, right? Your child has a marriage outside the faith, or back then a love marriage, all these things become kind of forms of stigma.
Yeah.
And then, you know, social media has created its own culture of shaming. So you think about, even with the changes that have taken place in India, to the extent that we continue to be that kind of shaming public culture, combine that with social media and you get something very toxic. And I think the point is right, that once he's paid his debt to society, he gets to move on also.
Yeah.
So let's move, you know, there's some other things. I mean, there's always a lot of things to talk about, but in the interest of, you know, I wouldn't say balance necessarily, but just, you know, myriad of things that sort of justified stereotype about India. You sent me a very delightful link to an article that Calcutta or Kolkata is the best food city in India.
Some Times of India guy, they just ran a thing. I think in this, one of these kind of world travel, like either CNN or...
Yeah.
I forget the exact... They've listed cities which you should go to for food. Right?
Yeah.
And Calcutta's figured. So I sent you that article. And the other thing that's happened is, over the last few years, particularly in the COVID lockdown, when I couldn't go and travel to India, I've been watching video blogs, of different people. And food blogging is a genre that has emerged quite a lot in Calcutta, also in Mumbai, where, you know, people talk about, you know, there's a prolonged discussion about, you know, Sev Puri, Vada Puri. In Calcutta, you know, where the egg roll is better, where the fish fry is better, that happens. So I read that, I sent that to you, and because I know you spent part of your childhood in Calcutta. Just that, you know, as a city, it is kind of a bit of a sinkhole. But there are so many aspects of it which are unlike any other. Now, you know, people like Veer Sanghvi have taken opportunity to kind of romanticize needlessly from the sidelines. You know, he's written like this gallivanting thing about pujas, which does the social media rounds every time puja comes around, that, you know, how Bengal is special, which is kind of a bit BS-y, you know, because it's a place without industry and future, in perpetual opposition to what's happening in the center. But the food is undeniable. And I think that's one of those things which makes it remarkable. I thought I'd share that. I'd be very interested what the other listeners on the podcast think about that city.
I mean, I should share, like, you know, one of my research interests is also food and communication and media. I've written a little bit on that. And I love reading graphic novels on food. There's a couple of fantastic ones. Maybe in another episode, I'll share some of that. We'll we'll do a literature film kind of, you know, series also. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one thing I'll also say about Calcutta, you know, a friend of mine many years ago had said that you can never be objective about the pop songs you hear in your childhood, right? Like, if you heard that same song now, you would like, boss, it's completely cheesy, right? But because it's so sort of interwoven with memories, so it's the same. Calcutta has that same, you know, place in my heart. I mean, I'm probably romanticizing it. I haven't been there in, you know, 2 decades now. Though I would really love the opportunity to make another trip. Yes, the food was fantastic. And growing up, you know, as, I mean, I've known you what now?
Long time. You
know, long time, 37, 38 years, something like that. Right. And we, during the pujas, we would have, you know, those egg roll stalls. We would have, you know, egg rolls. We had, what was that famous place? Biryani place? Shiraz.
I went back, recently I was in Calcutta about December time, attending a friend's wedding. Me, my sister and my mother went to Shiraz and tried it. And obviously there's now a family set up, an air conditioned section, etc. The biryani is really, really cool. I think, and yeah, the way they serve it with the egg, the potato and the piece of meat and everything, that it works as magic, right?
Oh, I still remember that meal. You know, we were kids. This is the India of the 80s.
But,
you know, we had a biryani and a half each, and we had thumbs up and we had firni.
Yes,
you know, those three ingredients. I mean, it's one of those moments in life where the food was just magical, right? So let me ask you, like, I know, you know, and of course I should, there's another quick point I want to make here, which is that Bengali hospitality is exquisite. And I think now there are some Bengali restaurants, there is a culture of Bengali restaurants, but in part, I think that, you know, because it's a, in many ways, much more complex cuisine than at least some aspects of North Indian cuisine, or all cuisines are complex, right? But you can make dosas to scale is what I'm saying. So I remember the exact moment in Delhi when the dosa kind of hit North India, which was, there was a restaurant called Sona Rupa. And, you know, I remember my grandparents, when they would come visit us, I was born in Chennai, then Madras. They, like, you know, discovered dosas, idlis, and they, like, completely tripped on it. But Bengali cuisine, perhaps because of its complexity, or, you know, just the nature of it, or the multiple courses and all, is not something that was, you know, other than something like rolls, was, you know, able to kind of take off, like, you know, butter chicken and so on. Now, I believe Calcutta has those as well.
It does. You're so great point. My only summary on that is, like the Bengali mindset, which is incredibly nuanced and complicated, so is the food. I think if you ask a person in Kerala how they fry their fish, they'll take fish, put it in oil, fry it. Right? You ask the same thing to a Bong, he'll give you multiple angles about, you know, what the fish, the temperature, the texture, the salting, the turmeric.
There will also be a reference to Rabindranath and one reference to some European intellectual, Antonini.
And you know, en route. So everything in the Bengali idiom gets kind of much more intricate and common. And that's what makes it interesting, right? You know, there is no two ways. You know, Rajma Chawal is Rajma Chawal, but in the Bengali pantheon of cooking, everybody has a special, like, you know, the kasba egg roll. You know, then, you know, it's very different from, you know, the Deshokriya Park egg roll, you know, which is very different because in one there are kasundi, there other than not.
So now we are going down the depths of Bengali psychology, which is even to regional psychology. And this is another set of episodes we will do. And we should warn you in advance that there will be some very good-hearted casual stereotyping. But let me just, you know, run with this for a minute more before maybe we touch on a couple of other topics. Yeah. What would you say are, like, top 5 foods, Bengali foods? Now, you could either do this as, you know, street food, or just food you eat outside, or, like, you know, cuisine generally, like, you know, Ghare and Baire, both. I mean, it's totally up to you. So
I'll give you my shout, and this varies tremendously. I think if you look, let's work it as a day clock, right? You wake up in the morning. The traditional breakfast of luchi and sabzi, which is kind of a puri and sabzi made Bengali style, I would say will be one of the andar ka khana, which is good. The other ghore, as you said, ghore bhai, that's a good way to go. If you're having lunch inside the house, light mildly stewed fish curry, stewed curry is something that's part, and also shukto. This is kind of the bitter gourd preparation that starts the meal.
Nice. Yeah.
It's very difficult to not difficult. It's kind of very tricky to get right because there are so many different variations.
Hmm.
That would be, and for dinner, obviously, Bengalis massively meat eater, so either chicken or mutton, that would be inside. And the mirror image of that outside will be, if you're eating breakfast outside, I would lean on this Bengali fixation of medium mild continental breakfast. This is huge fetish for going to Flurries and having
Flurries.
So, beans, toast, etc. So that kind of whole colonial capital hangover hasn't gone. So that, and long live that. It's still there in bits and bobs. Lunch, if you're eating outside, I think there are lots of famous, and I don't know, I mean, O Calcutta is a very famous chain of restaurants, which has done well, where you can go and do a very elaborate Bengali meal. And for dinner, obviously, you do biryani, which is the Calcutta biryani. That would be my reference. That's deeply personal. This is my show. Yeah. I know everybody, including if our friend circle, would have a completely different view.
Yeah. Right? So, and why not? And why not? That's part of the joy of it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Flurries, something about, I remember the magic of Flurries, you know, seeing those pastries from the outside, it used to have a glass shelf.
Yeah.
Park Street.
I think the one of the things about Bengali food, and particularly in the confectionery, the theater of confection, right? So whenever you go to a mithai shop in anywhere in North India, you'll see that the sweets are not that prominently on display. I think in Calcutta, my sense is, and you know, there are people who probably have done work on visual cultures to understand it, that, you know, the display of confectionery, whether it's cake or sweets, is like a unique art form. You know, Flurries does it, as do the mithai shops, right? You know, Calcutta. Yeah. There's this kind of, you know, the arrangement of sweets from expensive to inexpensive, the common sweets, which have the lower tier, you know, which are the popular fast-going ones. And then these kind of experimental ones on the top left of the shelf, you know, like electric chocolate sandesh. Why the word electric has been added, nobody knows. Because
getting chocolate into Indian mithais. There I'm with Kipling. East is east and west is west, and never.
I agree. But no, I think, you know, very fond memories. And I think to round up this stretch of the discussion, you know, I would encourage our readers, our listeners, to read that article and see if they agree with the one of the great food cities. You know, but I think also what makes me sad is the fact that Calcutta only makes the list as a food city, in terms of, you know, are things to see, things to do, other cities are head and shoulders above, or other cities have marketed themselves much better.
Right? I think the years I was in Calcutta, Calcutta was at its absolute nadir, right? 8-9 hours of load shedding every day, the 80s, I mean, terrible traffic jams, the work conditions weren't great. And I know that, you know, part of the reason, even like 15 years ago, 18 years ago, people said that there are no power cuts is because industry has moved and so on. I remember reading, you know, Amitav Ghosh actually wrote something very interesting, or he said this perhaps at a talk about, you look at post-industrial cities or cities that have suffered, once flourishing industrial cities that have suffered a setback in the West, and people have been enormously creative in the allocation of capital, or what's called the creative class, right? I see it in Berkeley, for instance, the area that used to have go downs, etc., completely rejuvenated. You know, it's become, there are like, you know, you'll have wine.com, a warehouse for an online place, you'll have restaurants, you'll have, you know, clubs and so on. And a lot of young people who work in, you know, the creative industries, so to speak, have sort of moved there. And he had asked this question about why can't we do this in our Indian cities? It was not just for Calcutta, but Calcutta was one of them. But I perhaps feel that, you know, we will see that it's possible. We might see that rejuvenation. You know, if we can, part of the problem also is that, you know, the local vested political interests and so on, the cost of real estate, the quick buck to be made, you know, Babu politician, developer nexus, all of that. But hopefully we'll see that. Well, I'll just give a quick shout out to two bloggers, I think. And, you know, I sort of, when I see them online or follow their Twitter accounts, or I used to. The Samar Halankar is one who actually is an amazing cook, and I think he talks a lot about his cooking. And then there's someone called Kalyan Karmakar, who also has a blog, and I'm sure there's tons more. So
funny you should mention Kalyan and me go back a long time. Kalyan is actually like a friend from another life, and you know, I'm so glad that you called him out because I didn't want to kind of needlessly self promote.
So sweet.
I'm a fan of his work and writing, and he's based in Bombay but writes about food and things like that. He's got a very cheerful style of writing, which makes it very
nice. Yeah, I remember that. All right. So let's run with one more topic. And this is sort of much more your wheelhouse than mine. I love cricket, but I think you're dedicated and consistent, and, you know, you really follow it. And you've been into the IPL, the T20 and the IPL for a long time. And in fact, it was you who introduced me to the fact that, look, man, you got to give T20 a chance, right? Yeah. And I got into it. And I want a quick shout out. Last year when I visited London for research and spent some time hanging out with you, one of the things we did was we went to the Lord's Pavilion, and I have Bunty to thank for that. And that was very memorable. That was very memorable. That was a bucket list moment. So thank you for that. So I am just a little bewildered about the pool of players that are there for the Indian cricket team, how the selections are made, what's going on. Some teams have been announced. I know that Kohli, Sharma not playing the T20s against New Zealand, but then people are saying that Sanju Samson has performed very well, but not given a chance. And then there's another player, I forget his name. He's been on an amazing streak in the Ranji game, but at some 170 average, but he's not got a chance. And then I asked on our Twitter account a question about, are we playing fewer tests? And a couple of people corrected me and said, no, the T20 game has not cannibalized tests, but it has cannibalized the ODI game, right? And then Kohli's on some kind of crazy streak, three centuries in his last four matches, one-day centuries, which is great. To me, it just seemed, though, I wish he got a chance to play a few more test matches, because, I don't think he's a guy who's a kind of stat padder, and I'm not one of those sort of record-obsessed Indians, but I just wonder if, the sort of overwhelming number of T20s and ODIs also, or the load that's been there on him, is one of the reasons that, his test game has taken a bit of a beating, because for a long time he was top of the heap and his average has gone below 50. So I'm just wondering about your thoughts about, this. Is there an excess of glut of cricket, and what are its costs?
No, I think anytime we talk about cricket, and particularly Indian cricket, we are not only up against 1.3 billion perspectives, but myriad others. And it's a $1 trillion industry. So every person who has a view is neither right or wrong. It's just a view. And I caveat that my views are pretty much much more minuscule in comparison. My broad point is, I think more cricket is good, because what we are doing is we are getting a diversity of offerings, each geared towards a particular type of cricket audience. Right now, Sharma uncle, who watched cricket in the 1960s, like Eknath Solkar and all of that, there's a place for him. And as long as categories don't try to reconvert each other. Sharma uncle will not, Tamil Nadu 2020 local, because there's a proliferation of T20 leagues across the world, across the region, right? Even in India, right? My broad take is more cricket is good, because each of these formats call for different skill sets. Now, which format is cannibalizing what? I tend to agree with the wider point, the earlier point that you made. I think there's a friction between one international T20 than with Test cricket, because that Test cricket is in and of itself a very standalone type of thing. Now, if you look at England and their cricketing setup, they have reconciled that to be a multi-format player, you not only have to have the skill, but you also have to be, as a person, willing to commit to three formats. I think the tragedy in Indian cricket at the moment is that because getting selected is such a kind of a freak show. You know, Surya Kumar Yadav is a case in point, who's doing phenomenally well, but he's had to be in the sidelines till his 30s because there are such fantastic cricketers, right? I think the problem in Indian cricket is that the whole kind of deselection, like when people say that he's been rested, right? Mm-hmm. It is seen as a euphemism for isko chhod diya gaya. Right. Now, which used to happen 2 years ago when somebody would say he was quote-unquote Chiteshwar Pujara has been rested for one-day internationals. That means Pujara can't play one day. He's a liability in that format. Right? What we, as we go forward, we'll realize that actually those words, rested, rotated, they actually mean what they say. There is no second layer sports world type meaning, like sneery sports world. You know, remember that drab sports world, like... essentially bitchy second rate journalists writing twisted, misquoting people. So my take is that, you know, when people have been rotated or rested, I think as we move forward with the proliferation of formats, that is more or less true. That's exactly what's happened. So my read of it is what it says on the can, that Kohli and Sharma have been rested for this thing, because there's a lot more cricket going through, right? Yeah. And I would like to think that the board of cricket in India realizes that there's a cohort of about 45, 50 players who address all these formats and any given combination. Now, the big question is, who are the people who make it in the list of 40? Because there are different contract types, contract.
Right, league, right, right. League, right. Yeah, yeah.
That Sanju Samson always gets a hard time. But you know, that's a whole episode in and of itself.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think broadly the point is, I welcome more cricket. I think it's good, and I think we should start respecting terms like respected, rested, rotated for what it is.
Yeah, I mean, I hope, you know, I don't think Kohli's a guy who will overstay his welcome, but I really, you know, he's so good to watch. I mean, I'm saying nothing profound here, right? There are people who are like far superior in the knowledge of their game. You know, I mean, starting with you. So what I have to say are banalities, but really, like, he's, you know, it's a pleasure watching Kohli play in there's a sort of, you know, the aesthetic pleasure of watching him play the test game. And he's very correct in whatever format he plays in, right? And then Surya Kumar is something else, right? It's just that, to me, watching those innings, and I'm grateful to you for you know, getting me onto the T20 game. And now, you know, winding down in terms of cricket, I mean, you and I are both, we are good-naturedly exasperated about Harsha Bhogle. I know he has his fan following, but I was a little, you know, I stayed up. I'm too old to, like, now, you know, get up in the middle of the night and stay up. But I did that for that first India-Pakistan match in the T20 World Cup. And I watched it. That last, you know, innings and a half, when Kohli was, you know, guiding us to victory, I mean, the guy just would not stop talking, boss. My point is that you have smart things to say, but, you know, sometimes, like, you don't have to get nervous around a silence. So anyway, that's just my, like, quibble. Nothing against him, no malice. I mean, he's a great guy, deserves, you know, everything. And I do think he was hard done by. And I, you know, I'm a fan of Kohli, admirers. But I think that years ago, I think Kohli, but also Bachchan piled onto it, said, you know, some silliness, saying that commentators need to be nationalistic. And Harsha Bhogle, I think, was kind of on the sidelines for a couple of years before that, before he came back. But we came across a Harsha Bhogle parody account.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think, look, Harsha Bhogle's main stock in trade is to say obvious things, right? That, you know, he's made a living out of saying that, you know, it is raining, therefore we need an umbrella. If it stops raining, we shouldn't put the umbrella away. So his whole philosophy of commentary is based around stating the obvious, that if the ball is coming to you, treat the ball on merit, right? If you do not treat it on merit, you run a risk, right? So this kind of, and there's somebody who's done like the real Harsha Bhogle, or on the other hand, or something like that.
Yeah,
it's wild reading through it. But quite rightly with you, look, I think English commentary, to find a genre of a style, a vibe, which is not like the Henry Blofelds of the world. Because, you know, when you look at other English commentators from the subcontinent, they're kind of trying to ape a style of, you know, a village cricketing great who's kind of partially alcoholic and prone to kind of casual sexual harassment. But because you remember that whole body of commentary where they would essentially leer at women and say,
I mean, it was awful. So Blofeld, okay, he was obsessed with earrings, fine, you're panning. Yeah. But there was something completely repellent with Vaseem Akram and Shastri. I mean, it was basically open lechery. It was called the Vaz and Shaz show. And during, you know, during the ad break or during the drinks break, they would actually focus and zoom in on women and they would like basically raid those women. And here you are, you know, two like lecherous old guys. I mean, it was just in very, very poor taste.
So, so the in defense, Harsha Bhogle is a counterpoint to that school of commentary. For which strength to him and the fans of him. Whether I'm a fan of him, I don't want to disclose, but I think, you know, I just think that he's made a wonderful career out of stating the obvious, and strength to him. It's an art.
And I have to say that, you know, as someone balding, I say this with envy, that I think Harsha Bhogle, and again, no judgment here, no body shaming, his money, his life, he's, you know, like he's regrown hair. So, you know, so to me, that's one of the greatest comebacks in the history of Indian cricket. Anyway, so again, no malice towards Harsha Bhogle. So we'll wrap up there. And listen, guys, hang in there. We'll chat again soon. I mean, we consider this a chat with you. Please send your, you know, your comments in. It's the start of the week. And during the week, in the words of the legendary Harsha Bhogle, like, just hang in there and play every ball on its merit, you know?
Yes, exactly. All right, take care, man.
Take care, man. Bye.